It's hard to find a case where he went against the core interests of his base as that base perceives it. He also says things that are demonstrably untrue, but he says them because his base believes him. So he sounds like a truth teller to them. And the efforts of fact checkers and things like that, it's clear the president often doesn't tell the truth. You can see through the polling that we've conducted that his base has now decided that having a president tell the truth is not that important a thing, which means that they know he's not necessarily the most accurate or truthful president, but because he's catering to what they perceive as their interests, they're willing to overlook that.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 23rd, 2020. Glenn Kessler is the head of the fact-checker staff of the Washington Post. Along with Salvador Rizzo and Meg Kelly, he is the author of the new book, Donald Trump and His Assault on Truth, The President's Falsehoods, Misleading Claims, and Flat-Out Lies. It is a compilation and distillation of the 19,000 false or misleading statements Donald Trump has made and the Washington Post has documented in its mammoth database of presidential untruths since the president took office. He joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about what makes Trump different from other presidents, the task of documenting the president's lack of candor on a daily basis, and what it all means to have a president who lies this much. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 23rd. Glenn Kessler on Donald Trump's assault on truth. Glenn, I want to start with the overall project of which this book is a piece. You didn't, you know, out of nowhere, walk into New York publishing houses or Washington Post publishing houses and say, I want to write a book about Donald Trump's false statements. This emerges out of a larger enterprise. So talk to us about the Washington Post's fact-checking operation and the project that led you to the project of this book.
Right. The Washington Post fact checker has been around. It essentially started in 2007 for the 2008 campaign. It was only existed for that campaign. It was revived in 2011. So we had been around a long time, well before Donald Trump decided he was a politician. And a core part of what we do is we vet the statements of politicians. We use those statements as a jumping off point to talk deeply about policy issues, to try to explain the mysteries of healthcare policy or foreign policy or any kinds of policies that are of the issues of the day in Washington. So when Trump showed up and he had this proclivity to make all sorts of statements or tweets that could be fact-checked kind of quickly, we were afraid it would take away from our core mission, which is trying to, to talk deeply about policy. So we decided to create a database where we would record every one of the president's false or misleading statements and, just have that in a place. So therefore, if he was repetitive, we could point to the database, or if it was a tweet that you literally could say, this is wrong and here's why in a few sentences, there was a place for it. And we wouldn't get distracted from our core mission. And we started it as a 100-day project, and readers asked us to keep going, and we did it for 1 year, and they asked us to keep going, and we said, well, this is manageable. It was about 6 false or misleading claims a day. But then after that, after the first year, the president really ramped up his proclivity to say false or misleading things. And so it became 16 claims a day in his second year, 22 claims a day in his third year, and it just keeps going.
Yeah, he's really, ramped up the winning in the false and misstatements department. When you confront somebody like Donald Trump, I imagine it creates a problem for the fact checker ethos, in the sense that the theory of the fact checker was always that you act in a nonpartisan way. When a Democratic politician makes a statement, you evaluate that and you elucidate policy through that. When a Republican politician does so, you do the same thing. And while you don't make a particular fetish about going back and forth, it kind of balances out and you end up calling all sides. And then you have somebody like Trump who simply behaves differently from other politicians and thereby causes you to devote a huge amount of attention to documenting, in this case, 16,000 false and misleading statements, which is not something that you do with any other politician. You don't have a database of Joe Biden's false or misleading statements or, Barack Obama's or, for that matter, Adam Schiff's, although you have called out Schiff on a few things. And so the result becomes that Trump and his supporters feel like you are devoting undue attention to their misleading and false statements rather than to everybody else's. And so I'm interested in your sense of how Trump fits into this larger project. Is this, you are now from now on going to have a database of for other presidents of their false and misleading statements that will be mostly much less full than Trump's if they're less apt to misstate things? Or is this just an extreme response to an extreme circumstance that we hope will not occur again?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I've not tried to think beyond this year. I mean, Joe Biden, of course, famously has his own issues with veracity. He's not the most precise politician, and his memory sometimes gets a little more fantastical about what he did or didn't do. I mean, earlier this year, I had to fact check him saying that he, saw Nelson Mandela in prison or marched with Nelson Mandela. I forget what the exact context was, but it was something that never happened. So if Biden wins the election, it's possible we could try to do a database. My guess is would never really get to the level of Trump, because Trump is unusual in that he's his own press secretary. He tweets constantly. I don't think any other president is necessarily going to do that. When we were fact-checking Barack Obama, Obama only ended up getting our worst rating, which is four Pinocchios, when he spoke off the cuff. And that didn't happen very often. He was very disciplined, and he had a staff that checked every fact and were prepared to defend every fact if it was in a prepared speech. I mean, he would rely on all the levers of government to make sure that what he said was correct. So it was kind of hard to catch him in a big whopper, and more likely we ended up with these fact checks that were one or two Pinocchios, where they kind of stretched the truth a bit to make a political point. So, I think Trump is really not the norm, and I don't know if he would be replicated, particularly if he loses re-election, because people might say that, well, I don't know if this necessarily worked for him.
Right. So I'm interested in your assessment of the constituent components of Trump's false statements. So you said of Biden that he's not a precise speaker and he's prone to exaggeration sometimes, and that's clearly true of Trump. Trump also does something that Biden doesn't do, which is maliciously make up facts about people, generally people he doesn't, who are opposed to him in some way. He also just babbles, which is a very dangerous thing for a politician to do, that Biden also does. So when you think about the constituent pieces of Trump's personality and verbal style that lead to this flood of misinformation, like, what are the components of it, and how would you assess how they're distributed?
Well, one key attribute of Trump is certainly his willingness to attack people with completely made up and false information. And there's a very nasty tone to the president's falsehoods, particularly when he's talking to people that he perceives as his enemy. And there was actually a psychologist that did a study of our database and studied how people lie. And so he said most lies are self-serving, you know, the ordinary person, and very few are mean-spirited. And she was stunned to see that 50% of Trump's lies were mean-spirited. And she said it was another unusual component that a lot of his false statements were not only denigrating of someone else, but also praiseworthy of him, which was an unusual combination. So in the case of Biden, as an example, he exaggerates about his past. He doesn't necessarily say, I can't think off the top of my head, where he said something nasty, made up about someone. Like, the, you know, most recently, Trump accused Joe Scarborough of essentially murdering one of his aides and suggesting falsely that he might have had a romantic relationship with her. That's not something that Biden ever does. And Trump is also unusually ill-informed about policy issues and remains ill-informed despite being corrected. It's almost impossible for someone to convince Trump that what he is saying is wrong, even with overwhelming evidence. Joe Biden is, you know, a very experienced politician who spent decades at the highest level of policymaking in the U.S. Congress and in the Obama administration. He would not make that kind of statements about NATO funding that Trump makes. Trump gets NATO funding wrong all the time. Biden would make the basic mistakes about trade policy that Trump makes on a constant basis.
And do you think, as a psychological matter, that Trump is intending to mislead when he does that? Or do you think that he convinces himself of something and at some level believes that the truth is what is most convenient for him for the truth to be? And so when he says, you know, that Pete Strzok and Lisa Page were engaged in treason and they had an insurance policy, which is a matter you guys treat in the book and is one that I, you know, personally have come to care about a great deal, that this is actually just something he's convinced himself is true.
Yes, it's, you know, we're sometimes criticized because we don't often use the word lie when we talk about Trump's falsehoods. But that's, you know, lie means you absolutely know the person knows what they are saying is false. President Trump is very situational. He doesn't care if he says something today that is completely different from what he said yesterday. And I think a lot of times he convinces himself it is the truth, even, again, in the face of overwhelming evidence that it's not true. And he cannot be persuaded that what he is saying is false. And I think his staff basically gives up and doesn't even try to explain to him. And instead, they spend a lot of time trying to reverse engineer a possible explanation for how he could possibly be somehow maybe a little bit right.
When you do the database is this giant catalog of the president's lies or false or misleading statements. The book is something else. How would you characterize the project you undertook in the book, and what's the value that it adds to the work that you guys have done on the Post's website itself?
Well, the database is now over 19,000 claims. It's a bit of a, you know, it's a very fast search engine. So you can go into it and type in a word like, I don't know, historically black colleges or something like that. And every time the president said something about that particular thing, you would get the quote as well as our fact check. But, you know, I don't know how many people sit there and go through our 19,000 claims.
I spent a lot of time on that database when Susan and I were writing our book, just speaking personally.
Okay, well, that's wonderful to hear. But it's not necessary. But you were researching a book, and one of the reasons we're doing this is for historians down the road. The book was intended to be a relatively compact package where all the key falsehoods or misstatements would be in one place according to various categories. And we picked the highlights. We didn't pick every false claim he made about foreign policy, but we picked the 20, 25 that are emblematic of the kinds of things that he says. And frankly, you know, I've lived this day by day since 2015, and we've obviously been working constantly on the database. I was pretty stunned when I saw it all in one place in a readable form at how overwhelming and encompassing his mendacity is. It's really something to see it all in one place.
And what do you conclude from that? I mean, the title of the book is Donald Trump and His Assault on the Truth. What does it tell you about our politics, about the unique figure of Donald Trump, about the state of our conversation as a society, that it is possible to have a president about whom you can say what you just said?
Well, I guess I would say it's a bit of a disturbing moment. I mean, as I write in the book, you know, every president lies at some point, and they do it for a variety of reasons. And they sometimes convince themselves it's necessary to do that in order to protect national security reasons or something like that. But to have the leader of the country mislead on such a consistent basis, even when he didn't need to. I mean, he had, before the coronavirus, he had pretty good economic numbers, but he would still inflate those, just routinely add 600,000 jobs he created to the number when he had no reason to. It was not a bad number. It was nearly 3 million. And I guess the other aspect of it is that it's a very interesting experiment that Trump is playing. He really only plays to his base, and he denigrates and ignores people that he thinks didn't vote for him. Now, that has resulted in pretty strong support among a core group of the American people. Because an ordinary president would at some point make compromises or make decisions that would disappoint that base. And Trump has not done that. It's hard to find a case where he went against the core interests of his base as that base perceives it. He also says things that are demonstrably untrue, but he says them because his base believes him. So he sounds like a truth teller to them. And the efforts of fact checkers and things like that, it's clear the president often doesn't tell the truth. You can see through the polling that we've conducted that his base has now decided that having a president tell the truth is not that important a thing, which means that they know he's not necessarily the most accurate or truthful president, but because he's catering to what they perceive as their interests, they're willing to overlook that.
Do you think that what's happening is that people are overlooking it? I mean, obviously that's some of it, but some of it is that I think he is defining a reality of his own, and that he is not wrong that the endless repetition of false facts makes them real for a lot of people. And I come back to the example of the campaign of defamation that he has engaged in against former FBI officials. And here I'm not thinking chiefly of Jim Comey, who has his own platform, but of lower level people who he has made into public names. He has mocks them at rallies. You know, I don't know to what extent, if you polled people, they would believe a lot of that at a kind of factual level. But I think a lot of people clearly do. And judging from the prevalence of repetition of those lies on Fox News and elsewhere. You certainly see them repeated endlessly on Twitter. So is it that people are overlooking the importance of truth in a and honesty in a president, or is that he's actually successfully redefining reality for a lot of people?
You mentioned the role of Fox News there. I mean, these narratives that the president spins out are then echoed in, you know, right-leaning media, such as Fox News or Breitbart or something like that. So it is quite possible these days to live in a world of your own reality if you're not reading the Washington Post or the New York Times or watching, you know, ABC News, and you're only existing on the diet of the president's tweets or Sean Hannity, you're going to have a definite alternative view of reality.
Let's talk about the organization of the book. So when you have 16 or 19,000 false or misleading statements, and you're not simply going to catalog them all, you end up with a question of what you're going to highlight and what the thematic work that you're trying to bring out is. So talk about how you organized the book and what that organization is designed to bring out.
There's a thematic introduction, just introducing people to both what the fact checker is and, you know, the overall view of the president and his use of false and misleading statements to, you know, set his political priorities. And then the first chapter is basically our top 10 list, which was difficult to select, but we tried to pick the 10 most significant falsehoods that he has told. And we broke those into different categories, you know, things where he brags about things he didn't do, or where he attacks, says that other people did things that they didn't. The second chapter is looking at how Trump talks about himself, the falsehoods he tells about his life, his career, his achievements. And then the chapter after that looks at how Trump attacks his enemies. And then we also follow that with a chapter on how he lies to his base, the kinds of statements he makes often at campaign rallies, where he tries to reassure them that he's on the right path or that they're all working together on the right path. The next chapter is a Twitter chapter, taking a look at his tweets. And that one, we tried to keep the explanations pretty quick and simple, much like tweets. And we looked first at the times where Trump has tweeted something that is completely contradictory to things that he's tweeted before. And then after that, the last part of the book is looking at particular issues. So Trump's false statements about immigration, his false statements about economics and trade, his false statements about foreign policy. We then have an impeachment chapter, that was one of the chapters I wrote. And actually, I'm particularly pleased with that chapter, though impeachment seems very distant and far away. But I was aiming to be able to provide in one place a very comprehensive overview of how the president managed to use his false statements to escape conviction for what he did there. And then lastly, we added a chapter at the very last minute about the coronavirus. The publisher was very good about allowing us the time to add that. So we then have a coronavirus chapter, which of course is unfolding continually. And then we have a conclusion on, you know, what does it mean, and whether or not Trump will be a success if this ultimately works for him. And then finally, we have an appendix where we take readers through one rally. We vetted every single factual statement the president made and checked to see if it was accurate or misleading or false. And in the end, about 70% of what he said was false or misleading, which is consistent with other rallies we've looked at. We had done it two previous times, which is kind of astonishing. And this was his longest rally ever. It was one he did in Battle Creek in December.
And other than the fact that the president lies and errs in telling the truth a lot. What's the big conclusion that you draw from all of this? I mean, you've spent more time, more energy on Trump's mendaciousness than anybody has. It's kind of been your career for the last 3 years, or a big chunk of it. So what's your takeaway?
My takeaway? That's an interesting question. I think ultimately, I conclude that this doesn't really work for the president, that he would have been more successful if he had tried harder to work at telling the truth. I may be wrong. I mean, maybe he's reelected. But I think that when you look at the polling, you see that there's not much support that he has. He's honest or trustworthy. His numbers are way below any other president, even Bill Clinton, who told some famous lies about his personal behavior. And he doesn't have much credibility with other world leaders because they feel like he's misled them. He doesn't have much credibility with members of Congress because they feel that he's misled them. And so he could have been a much more effective president if he had learned to, master subjects in more detail, if he had tried harder to work at telling the truth.
Yeah, so I want to foot stomp this point a little bit, because if you had asked you or me or any other sentient human being 5 years ago, so before we knew Donald Trump was going to run for president or be successful, what would happen if a president behaved this way? What we would have said is, well, he would lose credibility with the public. He would lose credibility with congressional leaders. He would lose credibility with foreign leaders. And it would dramatically impair his effectiveness. And so what you've just described, which I think is absolutely correct, is exactly what we all would have predicted would happen. Now, the only thing that we would have gotten wrong, I think, is that we would have predicted that it would impair it much more his effectiveness much more completely and much sooner. And the fact that Trump has been able to retain the support of large numbers of people, including his own congressional base within his political party in Congress, is not something that I would have predicted. But the general proposition that, there's a certain reservoir of credibility that a president has, and when you spend that down needlessly on lies on irrelevant things for self-grandiosity reasons or malicious reasons, you're spending down a scarce resource, is a sufficiently obvious point that it would have been wholly predictable. And so I guess my question is, why do you think he does it? If it's predictably bad, it in fact plays out as badly or almost as badly as you would have predicted. What's behind the endless flood of false information? Is it pathological? Is there some strategic element to it? Is it actually a war on truth, as your title describes it, that he's, trying to attack the concept of truth? Or is it just an ill-considered, unmotivated feature of his personality?
I think it's the last element there. I covered him as a business reporter when he was still a real estate developer in the 1990s. Donald Trump has not changed. He's exactly the same person. But now he's in the public stage. I actually think one reason he gets so mad at the so-called fake news is I think he expected that he would become president and he would only get positive news stories. And that's because he was the president. He could dictate that. And so he gets angry when people report accurately about what happened. And he's always lived in his own web of spin and deceit. And he hasn't really changed. I mean, every president comes to the job with a certain set of tools and experience. And the ones that are successful are the ones that are able to grow and improve as they move along, as they, you know, remain in the job. There's some that get overwhelmed by it. There are others that don't show the capacity to grow at all. But generally, you see a president, you know, understand, okay, this doesn't work. I've got to work with these people to do it this way. I've got to show a little bit of accommodation. And Trump has not shown that capacity at all. Now, in some cases, you could say that that has maybe worked for him. I mean, the previous presidents would have in some way negotiated some sort of agreement with a with an impeachment inquiry to allow for some testimony or to allow for some documents to be brought forward instead of a complete stonewall. And you could also argue that the one reason why members of his own party are reluctant to cross him is that Trump has demonstrated, if you cross me, I will destroy you. Other presidents would try to, you know, they would accept, they were politicians, they would accept, I got to let this person get a little bit off the reservation and critique me a little bit, but I'm going to get them on my side on this other issue. And so we're going to work it out. And so that would allow people to have some distance from the president. In this case, Trump has made it clear, you're either with me 100% or you're not with me at all. And that has put the fear of God in a lot of these people. So therefore, he doesn't get the kind of dissent within his own party that other presidents did.
So one of the features of Trump is that he comes at a time when he is not the only foreign leader, or he's not the only leader internationally who behaves the way he does, although he does it in a kind of exaggerated fashion. But, you know, bombastic, truth-offending sort of authoritarian populist leaders of this type are proliferating. And there does seem to be a one thing that a lot of them have in common is a kind of propensity to disinformation, including the kind of creation of allied media enterprises that are devoted to kind of fawning coverage. And so I'm curious, I mean, your focus was very much on Trump, but I'm curious whether you think there's something larger going on in the sort of war on truth department. Is it a kind of multi-front world war, or is Donald Trump a particularly unusual figure, or both?
Well, I think you see the impact of Trump in the way these other leaders respond. I spent 9 years covering foreign policy for the Washington Post before I did the fact checker. And I think some of the longest term legacy effects of the Trump presidency is the complete discarding of the United States as some sort of paragon for the rest of the world in terms of democracy promotion and setting an example. If you didn't have Trump there, if you had an ordinary American president who didn't say things like, you know, CNN is fake news or the Washington Post is fake news, attacking their political rivals in the way they do, taking the Justice Department and trying to make it a tool of the White House as opposed to supposedly a political organization. All those things. These other leaders that had these populist tendencies see that and say, well, if he's doing it, I can do it. The word fake news, that's Trump. And it now it's used everywhere by wannabe autocrats. You know, and also Trump's mixing of his business enterprises with his politics and the refusal to reveal his taxes or to give up his ownership. Those were all things that have a huge impact. And the next American president is going to have a real trouble going around the world and saying, you know, you've got to actually pay, you've got to believe in a free press, or you've got to actually build up your democratic institutions, or you shouldn't be having crony capitalism mixing this up. Because they're going to laugh in his face and say, well, what happened with the last guy you had? And I know a colleague of mine actually told me that after Trump was elected, you know, there was a senior government official from a major partner of the United States who said, well, one thing about this is we won't have to listen to your BS anymore about how you're a paragon of virtue.
I think there's a lot in that. Your last chapter is thematically built around the idea of a resurgence of truth. And I want to close with a sense of your optimism or pessimism on that score. A lot of the trends that you just described are pretty negative in that regard. Are we on the precipice of a kind of resurgence of truth, or is that more an aspirational statement than a realistic, predictive one?
Well, as I write in the book, it's a bit of a fool's errand to try to predict the impact of a president and how history will view him. And a lot of it has to do with, frankly, is whether he gets reelected. Because if he's reelected, despite, you know, saying so many things that are false or misleading, the other politicians are simply going to conclude, well, that doesn't matter as much to people as I used to think it did. Because one thing we noticed over the years, writing the Fact Checker, is that often if we called someone out and said, this is a whopper, they would stop saying it. That's not the case with President Trump. But on the other hand, if he loses, the reaction to, you know, as I write in the book, you know, every action in politics has a reaction. And you know, we could see during the Democratic primaries that the Democrats were actually very eager not to get Pinocchios. They did not want to be in the same category as President Trump. And they would actually, one of the rules we have is if you say something that's wrong and but you come and say, I made a mistake, we won't actually award the Pinocchios. And we had this situation where, in fact, Joe Biden, he said something false about his opposition to the invasion of Iraq. And I called the campaign and said, I got all these statements. We're going to write something here saying this is false. And the next thing I knew, I had a statement from Biden saying, I made a mistake. I should not have said this. It was all to avoid getting the Pinocchios.
So at the end of the day, are you optimistic that we can return to any kind of a cultural expectation of truth from presidents, or are you sort of agnostic on the subject? Or does it all depend on the re-election?
Well, a lot depends on that. So another 4 years of Trump, he's not going to change, really. He'll keep doing this thing he did. And as I write in the book, you know, the George W. Bush administration was upended for months because the president said one thing that was false in the State of the Union address. Now Trump says things that are false, dozens of things that are false in the State of the Union address, and people barely bat an eye. And so it depends on whether or not Trump is reelected. It also depends on how the next president handles himself and whether or not they actually make an effort to restore people's confidence in the words of the president. And I, like I noted, Joe Biden is, you know, I've covered Biden now for a couple of decades, and he has an issue where he exaggerates and stretches things. So we'll be waiting and watching, and we'll be calling him out if that's the case, but hopefully it will not be on the scale of what President Trump has done.
The book is Donald Trump and His Assault on Truth, The President's Falsehoods, Misleading Claims, and Flat-Out Lies. The lead author is Glenn Kessler of The Washington Post. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share us on Facebook, tweet us on Twitter, pin us on Pinterest. upvote us on Reddit, and of course, leave a review and a rating wherever you found us. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of the law firm of Goat and Rowe and D.O. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.